This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
I'm Ben Gideon.
Ben, happy almost Thanksgiving. I know it puts a timestamp on our podcast, but what do you have planned?
We're doing a Friendsgiving this year where we go to just good friends' home. I really like that because we don't have to do any work in terms of preparations, no cleanup, and very minimal exposure to family. How about you?
I've got about 30 family members coming over to the house, which is awesome, but it's about half the size of last year. We had 70 family members coming from all over the country last year, which was really, really cool. It's kind of been a tradition that we do it at our house. And I was telling Jeff, the weather's really rough here in California. So we usually do it outside. So we're able to actually accommodate everybody. But so this will be an intimate, tiny little one today this year.
I'm kind of hurt here. I've got a Friendsgiving where I'm not invited. And then I've got like 1,000 family members where I'm not invited.
So in terms of that, are you actually in charge of the meal and cooking and stuff? Or do you guys, I'm guessing you guys have it catered or something.
No. So we definitely do not have it catered. So I'm in charge of the turkeys, gravy, and then maybe stuffing. And then Smith is in charge of yams, mashed potatoes, and pies. And then other family members bring extra sides, and then it kind of builds around that.
That's funny.
We've got the whole thing set. Yeah.
It's funny how Smith got root vegetables. How did that happen?
You know what? That's for another podcast. So
yeah. All right. Well, I think we've already outstayed our welcome on the boring introductory chit chat. So with that, let's introduce our guest, Jeff Kroll, who's a trial lawyer from Chicago. Jeff has many monster verdicts, settlements, and a whole different range of different types of cases from product liability, personal injury, trucking, medical malpractice. But before we get into all these great accomplishments, Jeff, I was happened to be reading your CV here, which lists your articles and publications, and a couple of them jumped out at me for particular interest. One is a speech you apparently gave on Lessons from Bruce Springsteen, Lyrics of Hope-Dreams Guide Practice. I'm particularly interested in that because I'm a huge Springsteen fan. I saw him twice on his recent tour. In fact, as recently as probably about a month ago in Foxborough, but love Springsteen and kind of interested in how you connected the lessons from Springsteen to the work we do as trial lawyers. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, I've seen Springsteen 18 times. I think if you total all my concerts, it doesn't equal Springsteen. But I love his lyrics. All men want to be rich. Rich men want to be kings. A king ain't satisfied till he owns everything. And that kind of goes to greed of these defense experts. There's a myriad of other lyrics.
Badlands, right?
All that stuff. It's awesome. And my son is 22, and I took him to see his first Springsteen concert because, you know, he's into a lot different music. Way more musical than I am. And I think the F word is used in every song he's ever listened to. So that's why I love the Springsteens of the world, that just they're down to earth and they're lessons that we all can live by. And I just love that because I think what resonates with a jury, it's how do you relate to a jury? And it's really, you've got to get in their skin to some extent. So if you think you're the smartest guy in the room, you lost them already. So Springsteen doesn't think he's the smartest guy in the room. Springsteen seems like the kind of guy I'd be sitting at a bar next to having a drink, and you could talk about anything, and you walk away with that with a new best friend. I want to walk away with this juror thinking I'm their friend, I'm their guide. I'm not Springsteen. I can't sing, but man, I love his lyrics. I really do.
Yeah, I share that love for it. And there's something about that, and we talked about this with one of our prior guests. It was kind of the themes of country music and how that relates to what we do as trial lawyers. But there's something about successful musicians and lyrics that connect with people that I feel like it's kind of the same thing we're trying to do, you know, without the guitar licks, but trying to connect on that level. So that's pretty interesting. So there's another article I flagged that you wrote that is entitled Losing at Trial, Winning in Life, Lessons Learned in Court and Playing Wiffle Ball. So tell us about that one.
Growing up in the city of Chicago and hanging out in an alley pretty much about 10 hours a day, you played a lot of wiffle ball. And garbage can was first base. If you hit it in Mrs. Gonzalez's yard, you're out because there's a dog in there. And then whoever hit it had to go get it. It's all these about getting along and working with others. I've had, you know, some success with trials, but I've lost some trials. And the ones I've lost, I can almost pinpoint something I wish I did over. Or I wish I didn't call that witness. Or word choice. I wish I used a different word instead of this word because that word came back to haunt me. It's those lessons we learn as kids, lessons that we learn as trial lawyers and our losses, you know, the lessons we learn from the Springsteen lyrics, what have you. But it all helps us make who we are. But more importantly, how do we convince these 12 people that don't want to be there for the most part, these jurors? How do we convince them to right this wrong?
So how did those losses, whichever ones they are, translate into winning in life?
Being more, as my son, I had a great conversation with him not too long ago. He's a senior in college at Michigan. We were talking about it. It's a lightning rod right now. I'm just mentioning that school. But I said, what have you learned in those 4 years there? And he's like, I've learned to adapt. I've learned to go with the flow. And you know, sometimes I've lost cases because I'm trying to fit this square peg into a round hole when I should have probably done something differently. But you're stubborn because it worked in this other case. But every case is so different. Every jury's different. Some jurors are more visual. Some, they listen. They've got these auditory skills. And sometimes we as lawyers are so stubborn because we think we know better. And I've lost a couple trials where I thought I knew better. And you know what? I didn't. And I'm sure you guys have gone through this. You kind of walk away from something thinking like, that did not go the way I was hoping it would go. And sometimes you hope they don't see it, but guess what? They almost always see it.
So how did you get from wiffle ball in the alleys of Chicago with a garbage can for first base to where you are now, which is at least, I would say, third base and maybe even a home run with your career and success trying cases?
I'm still a garbage can away from reality. You know, I grew up in a blue collar family. My dad was a truck driver. My mom was a bank teller. No one went to law school. None of us lawyers were bad. The only reason you need a lawyer is because you got arrested type of thing. I grew up in a very, very ethnic blue collar community where if you crossed a certain street, you're going to get beat up by another group of guys. And if you rode your bike in this other area, you're going to get beat up by another group of guys. It sounds stupid and juvenile, but you knew the boundaries. And I remember I went to college. I went to a small school in Wisconsin called Whitewater, where my buddy, who's now the head coach of Kansas football, was the quarterback. I was a wide receiver because I thought I was going to be the next Bo Jackson, playing a couple of different sports and pros, all 5'8" of me, weighing about 150 pounds. Obviously, that did not pan out. So I quit college after a year and a half, and I decided I was taking coaching classes, and I had like a 2.7 grade point average. It was what it was. But then I remember I quit college. I'm like, I'm not going to college. It's not for me. And my dad got called at 3 a.m. to go plow like snow. In California, you don't have these issues, but in other parts of the country, we do. But I remember he got called at 3 a.m. to go plow, and I'm thinking like, I don't want this life. And I kind of buckled down and went to DePaul in the city of Chicago and did fairly well. And I took a business law class. It's amazing how in life you can have a professor or teacher that shapes or influences what you wind up doing for the rest of your life or what you wind up enjoying. So I took this business law class because it was required for my major, and I loved it. I loved it in college. And so I thought, I'm going to become a lawyer someday. And my dad kind of, yeah, right. Good luck kind of on that. And the rest is kind of history. I had some phenomenal mentors. And if I have a theme that I want to get out of this, I mean, having a mentor is of the utmost importance in our career. I really believe it. And I know just from reading you guys' bios and where you're at, you guys had mentors. Because if not, there's no way you're where you're at today.
Who was your mentor?
You know, my first job was with Bob Clifford, Clifford Law Offices.
Oh, yeah.
He was my mentor, and he knows Brian Panich and those guys, you know, Kevin Durkin and all those guys. And
oh, yeah.
I was fortunate, but it's a different, and I know you guys will appreciate this. Clifford told me when I started, I'll hire you, but under this premise, Philo. And I'm like, Philo? He goes, yeah, you're the first in, last out. You're in there all day, all night, and you don't think anything of it. You're like, okay, that's fine. I mean, today, it's a different generation now. I don't even know what Philo would stand for. I just, FOMO, my daughter, 15, fear of missing out. God forbid if she doesn't attend a party or something like that. But it's a different generation. You know, having these mentors where you just hang on their every word, you watch them, you're amazed by them. But then when you have an issue, if you can talk to them about something, it's amazing. When we as lawyers put aside our egos and aren't afraid to pick up the phone and call you guys for what's your thoughts on this. You know, I talked to you guys before this. I've got a trial December 5th. I'm going to show you guys the video. I want your thoughts. And I know I'm going to get honest thoughts. You're not going to placate them just like, well, oh, that's great, Jeff. Good luck. That's where we as lawyers, we as human beings learn, is by getting these mentors, asking questions, learning things, getting preparation. That was the three words he said to be successful. I may lose trials. I'm not going to get outworked. And I think that's what I can look myself in the mirror at the end of the day when my career is done. I gave it my best. Did I win everything? No. As someone once told me, show me someone that hasn't lost a trial. I'll show you someone that hasn't tried many cases. And I think there's a lot of truth to that.
What kind of takeaways did you get from your time working with Bob Clifford?
Well, one of the funniest lines, and I said this to him a couple of years ago, but my first four trials, you know, I got sworn in on Thursday. I was starting a trial on Monday, a med-mal by myself, which was one of the quickest not guilties in Illinois history, mind you. But my first four trials were not guilty. He said to me, he's like, I just want you to remember, our goal is to get numbers, not letters. And I'm like, and I'm like, okay, you know, but it's those kinds of lessons. It's watching a mentor, how they interact with opposing counsel or a judge or an expert. Let's face it, there are things that you can get away with today that you couldn't get away with as a new lawyer with certain judges. And I tried to be Bob Clifford, and it didn't work because I didn't have that cachet. I didn't have that, you know, whatever. But I had to be Jeff Kroll, and Jeff Kroll is different than Bob Clifford. I think when I started to realize I need to be myself, I think I'm sarcastic. Sometimes your personality is your best asset at a trial. When you're truly yourself and a juror looks at you and like, ah, that guy's cool, or that woman, that she got him on that one. That's what it's all about, is really being yourself. And sometimes we're so afraid to be ourselves in front of jurors.
Do you actually get sarcastic with witnesses in front of the jury?
Yeah, I do. Of course, there's a guy named Brian Panich. I would love to see him in front of the jury. But it's like, I'll be like theatrical. Like, I remember someone said something very different in my last trial. I'm like, whoa, wait. I thought I just heard this. I know it can't be true. Did I just hear, you know, something like that, where now all focus is, I want the jury looking at me. And I'll be like, I thought you said that you're going 20, and I know that's not true. And, you know, just something like where I'm building up that cross-examination. You know, but you know, sometimes jurors don't like that. You know, you got to read your audience, man, and it's tough. And that's why I'm trying to make, my cross-examination, I'm focused on the jury. I'm almost always watching the jury as I'm talking, because I want them looking at me versus looking at the witness, because I can care less about the witness. It's about me. maybe it's egotistical, but I want these 12 sets of eyes staring at Jeff Kroll thinking, what's he going to say next type of thing.
I'm curious because that example you just gave, it seems like maybe in Illinois, or particularly like Chicago, given your roots there and your Midwestern Chicago accent, you'd probably be, juries would perceive you as one of them, that you grew up in the community and you're part of the community. And I think what you just did, maybe kind of an out extension of that a little bit. Like, I don't think that would go over well in the stodgy New England juries that we appear in front of. They have very little tolerance for things like that, and it can backfire. Although, honestly, maybe it could work fine with some juries too. But I'm curious how, I know you've had cases in different parts of the country and even different venues, just within Illinois, rural versus urban. Have you noticed differences in the culture of juries that dictates how you might present yourself?
100%. I'm not naive enough to think that what works in Chicago will work in Maine type of thing. Funny story. I tried a case in South Carolina, Greenville, South Carolina, Bob Jones University, very conservative area. I was listening to the defense lawyers thinking, my God, they've got this Southern drawl. They sound awesome. I don't have a chance. And I tried the case and I was more on my better behavior than the sarcastic because of the jurors I selected. And you know, I wound up getting a $7 million verdict in a malpractice case, which was one of the largest verdicts. And the jurors are like, God, we loved your voice. And I'm like, my voice? Like, I hate my voice. My family hates my voice. But you know, but it's, and here I'm sitting there thinking, like, if I can get that Southern draw, here's a funny story, which you guys will appreciate. And you can steal this and use it someday, hopefully. Try a Med Mal case in a conservative area, once again, you know, where it was, there's no Cook County, no Chicago people near there. I was 30 years old. Defense lawyer was 62, and he was a stud lawyer. And I felt like I had a good Med Mal case. So in my closing argument, I asked for whatever. And he gets up and all of a sudden he starts with this, like almost like a Southern drawl. He's like, Mr. Kroll, I love you. I remember when I was a young man, when I wanted to go to a picture show, and that's what we called it, a picture show, I'd ask my dad for 10 cents, but I only really needed 5. And that's what Mr. Kroll's doing here today. He's asking for the 10 cents, but he wants the 5. And so my rebuttal, I got up, I looked at defense counsel, I walked behind defense counsel, and I said, ladies and gentlemen, this is a case about who do you believe, me or him? You just found out he would lie to his father for 5 cents. What do you think he's going to do to you? So it was so that, like, the sarcasm came out, and it doesn't work in every venue. But the jury kind of laughed there, and I'm like, okay, that's a good sign. Because if they would have just, trust me, I've had the same situation where they fold their arms like, are you done yet? You know,
I like that. That's really good. Did you just think of that on the spot? You must have.
On the spot, yeah. And I tried using something like that once again. Fell flat on his face. I'd love to say use it on every case. But it's just, it's that wit that we have as lawyers that I say sarcasm, and that's not really, it's, I think wit is the better word than sarcasm. I remember I tried a case against a guy in Chicago, and he was from Harvard, undergrad, Yale Law School, and I knew I had him. The lawyer, because it was like someone would mention something. I'm like, oh, you live by Jefferson. A juror would say something. I'm like, oh, how far are you from Jefferson Park? Oh, there's a great little Italian. Yes, that's the Italian. Yes. Okay. And like, I just want to suck up in those moments. And I knew this guy knew nothing about Chicago. And the verdict wound up going well, but because I just don't think the jurors connected with that person. And there's a guy named John Romano, Connectionology and all this. He's a stud. And I learned so much from the Brian Panish's world, the John Romano's. And it's just kind of being yourself. I keep mentioning Brian because he's one of the best lawyers in America, if not the best.
This show is primarily devoted to extolling the virtues of Brian Panish.
Yeah. But he's
just good for Rahul's business, too. So we appreciate it.
But he's who he is. He's who he is. He's not fake. Nothing fake about him.
It shares your love for football, by the way.
Well, I love sports. It's a whole different podcast.
So that you mentioned that term connectionology, and I've seen that used. What is that actually?
It sounds simple, but it's the ability to connect with these jurors or with a judge or something. And it's finding that thread that they relate to you or your case. And if you kind of looked at my bio or CV, I've spoken around the country on using themes and analogies to persuade. And I think using you have to have a theme. In 10 words or less, what is your case about? It's like you go to a cocktail party and, you know, here, Thanksgiving, you're going to have, well, you got 200 people coming over, whatever. I'm not one of them. But you've got all these people coming up and then they're like, what's your next trial about? And well, my client was going north. Well, it was north/north. You've lost them. I have a case about broken bones and broken dreams. It's a recipe for disaster. All of these things. You have to give them that Kentucky Fried Chicken secret recipe to Coca-Cola, where you give them your theme. And when they repeat it at the end of a trial, man, there's no better feeling. In Illinois, we get to talk to jurors afterwards. I don't know if you could do that in Maine or California. When I lose, I don't like talking to them because typically they're just, oh, you did a great job. It was close, you know, and then I'm thinking that the jury was out for 11 minutes. Just wasn't that close. It's just finding out what resonates with people. And that's why you think about, if you have your list of cases and think about what is this case about in 10 words or less, it's tough. It's tough. But a lane change caused a life change. So what does that mean? Well, with every liability witness, I talked about a lane change. Every damage witness was a life change. So the case coincided with my theme. A lane change caused a life change. And you know, it's things like that where you just be creative. I mean, so many lawyers are just connect the dots, 1, 2, 3, you know, and you gotta step outside the box every once in a while.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. Can you give us a couple examples of cases you tried and how you framed it or themed it like that? Maybe including that case where you got the $148 million verdict.
Yeah, that was a special case. Big verdicts result in bad decisions a lot of times by insurance companies, and more importantly, having a good plaintiff. And she was a phenomenal plaintiff. I don't know if your listeners are all aware of this, so I'll bring it up, but I'm confident you guys are aware of this. There's a concept known as anchoring. And so we can talk a little bit about the focus groups in a little bit. We learned so much about them. But anchoring is where you try to anchor jurors to your number versus the defense side's number. So for example, if I saw this done and it was phenomenal, so it's not mine, I stole it. And just like any lawyer, if you're not stealing, according to all my friends that don't go to Michigan, if you're not cheating, you're not winning, you know, kind of thing. But they divided the room in half and they said the population of Turkey is blank. And so one half of the room saw a number 350 billion. The other half of the room saw 10 million. So the 350 were like, I think that's high. I think it's closer to 250, maybe three, but 250. The 10 was anchored to, that seems low, maybe 15, maybe 20. Well, the right answer is 80. But see how you anchor them at specific numbers they're thinking about. It. So during jury selection, every juror, if the facts and evidence support a verdict in excess of $150 million, could you award such a verdict? And yeah, I guess. You know, so we kept anchoring them at 150. My opening statement, I talked about, we're going to ask for in excess of 150. During jury selection, one of the jurors, the youngest juror, asked the defense lawyer, we've heard 100 times about 150 million. You have not thrown up a number. What's your number? I'll get to that in an opening statement. I'm thinking like, you got to address that. You got to address that type of thing. So this anchoring concept is so important. You know, whether you're talking about future economic damages, you got to anchor them to that number and make sure that they bought into it and they get it. And the jurors came back in that case with, we did three focus groups. So briefly bring up, but the first focus group, we asked for 100 million and it was great liability, damages only trial. She was paralyzed from the waist down, no punitives. It was all solely compensatory. But the first trial we asked, or first focus group, we asked for $100 million. I think the jury came back at 60 or 70. Second one, we asked for 200 and they gave us less because they thought we were being greedy. It goes to the lawyers. We then asked for 150 and the jury came back over $100 million. So we knew our number to ask for was going to be between 150 and 200 million, which is a ridiculous amount of money. I mean, to some people, we did not make a demand in that case. So many of us as lawyers, we wind up trying our bad cases and settling our good cases. And we did not make a settlement demand. The day before trial, they offered us $30 million. We did not respond. They said, it's your turn to respond. We said, we're not going to respond. Give us your best dollar amount. And they said, we just offered 30. I mean, I slept like a baby after that. Like, I sleep for 2 hours, wake up crying, go back to bed. Just, that was a big number to turn down for a case. And, but it was, it's exciting. I mean, being a trial lawyer, we joke about being involved with sports and what have you. I love the competition. It's a zero sum game. There's a winner and there's a loser. I mean, this isn't Ted Lasso where everybody kumbaya, let's hug everybody. It's like football. Yeah, I mean, you're going to win or lose. That's it.
Well, in that case, obviously the court permitted you to pre-qualify people with a specific number. I know I study Rahul's voir dire, and where I've seen you do that, Rahul, you do exactly that, which triggered some objections, but ultimately you're allowed to do that. In the Northeast, it's less common that a judge would allow that. They often explicitly prevent you from doing that. They'll tell you in voir dire, you can't tell the jury what your number is. You can't tell them you're going to ask for a specific number. So I've found other creative ways to do the anchoring, but I'm curious, do you have other strategies for anchoring jurors to numbers if you're not allowed to do that approach?
Well, you know, and I'd love to hear Rahul's like explanation of this, because I don't like asking a specific number, because if my case goes a little south, and now I said I'm going to ask for over 150 and it goes south, and if I don't ask for 150, I look like an idiot. If I ask for 150, I look like an idiot because the case isn't worth it and I lost all credibility. So once again, if the facts and evidence support such a verdict, we've got good case law in Illinois on this subject matter. I don't know about California. It sounds like Maine doesn't really have much, which permits this type of inquiry of jurors. I think it's so important to get a fair and impartial jury, and that's why you need to go into this area of questioning. But the concept of anchoring, I mean, it could be with your economist. It could be with a myriad of different issues. It could be with an employer. It's just getting that number out there as often as possible. Like Chicago politics and voting, do it early, do it often. And that's kind of what anchoring should be.
So one of the things, though, and I know you said you did three focus groups on your case, I assume those helped you with some guidance on what you would be asking the jury for. And in those focus groups, then this is what I find interesting, because I don't know, I've read that article on anchoring, and I guess just maybe it's my state of mind. I don't necessarily think about it as anchoring as much as identifying which jurors are already closed-minded to the issue. And thinking about focus groups, there's no time in, you don't select those people through voir dire. You present your case in a truncated form. And then they, depending on how your focus group is set up, they either independently complete a verdict form or do it in groups and then reach a number. So without any of that voir dire questioning, asking if the evidence supported it, is there anything in their belief system that prevents them from supporting a verdict in whatever amount? You just get right to it. And that's what provides your guidance for what you're going to be asking a jury potentially. It's an interesting issue as to whether it actually anchors people, whatever you do in jury selection, or if you're actually able to just identify people who are not pre-anchored, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it's six and one, half dozen the other from what, because I agree with you. I couldn't agree more. I just want that number getting out there. I just want them hearing it. So all of a sudden, in closing argument, which has happened to me, I had a woman that was going to potentially go blind. It was one of my first four not guilties where I started off on such a hot streak. I remember I asked for future disability of $2 million or whatever it was, and two jurors in the front row that were crying earlier when I was talking about my client. When I said $2 million, they threw their pens down. I'm like, okay, I need to focus on the other 10 because I just lost these two here. I was just joking about the 2 million. I meant 200,000. I'm just joking.
After the string of not guilties, as you call them, when you were just getting started as a baby lawyer, did you ever have a moment where you thought, well, maybe this isn't for me, or maybe I made a big mistake? Probably you had a lot of moments like that. But assuming the answer to that might be yes, how did you kind of keep going with perseverance? And then what was that moment where you realized you had that spark that this was something you really were going to be good at and could find success in?
I'm glad this isn't on video because I was smiling because you were saying, was there a moment? I'm like, yeah, it wasn't a moment. It was like days and weeks and months.
Right. During my question, I realized the absurdity of the question itself. So
I'm sitting there like, I picked the wrong profession. I'm not good at this at all. I won't mention her last name. So there was a young lady named Paula who I represented, and it was in a conservative county in Illinois. And Raul knows it's by Great America, Lake County up north there, by close to the Wisconsin border. And there was a good liability case. I'm not going to give you facts. But anyway, so my client, now this is on my string of not guilties, and I'm going against a lawyer that is a stud. But I have a good liability case. I tell the client, if they offer anywhere near $400,000, I think you should take it because it's Lake County, it's conservative, blah, blah, blah. We go through this whole thing. Clifford tells me, you need a trial, try this case. And I said, well, they're offering 300. So then they come up to 700,000. And my client, I'm like thinking, like, I tell Clifford, I'm like, they're offering 700. He goes, get a verdict. I'm like, gosh, I'm thinking I can't lose another one. Like, so literally we wound up getting, I think 2.6 or 2.8 million in this county. But I remember the conversation with my client beforehand. She's like, are you sure we can beat the 700? And I said, absolutely not. And I said, but I need you to trust me. And you talk about those moments, Ben. That was a moment where I'm thinking, if this doesn't work out, I am hurting clients versus helping them type of thing. So that verdict went well for me. And then I went on a hot streak for a while. But it's scary because you do question yourself on a loss or when the verdict comes back less than the offer. If you don't question yourself, you shouldn't be in this profession because your heart isn't in it.
I mean, that is a smaller microcosm of the issue you confronted when you turned down 30 million, right?
Yeah.
And that, when you start to get to 30 million for a single individual person, that's a life-changing, almost generational changing amount of money. I mean, not close to what you ultimately were able to, I'm sure, recover after your verdict, but still 30 million would do pretty well for most people, right? And what was the conversation with your client like for that?
But what's our issue, though? Is our issue as lawyers to make them comfortable, or is it to maximize their recovery? And to make them comfortable, half our cases would settle right from the get-go, you know, because they got their medical bills paid and they got some money in the pocket and they're back to their lives, whatever. But as lawyers, what are we doing to maximize our recovery for our clients? And that's, I think we all know, trust me, we'd be all lying if we didn't say we know a bunch of lawyers that would settle for that 200,000 or 400,000 or whatever easily versus taking it to trial. We've got the ones that refer us cases half the time. They can't settle their cases. And, you know, if you're going to be a bear, be a grizzly. Let's try some cases. Clifford used to say there's two kinds of people. There's healers and warriors. Healers settle cases, warriors try cases. Once you become a warrior, it's very easy to become a healer. It's tougher to become a warrior when you're a healer, if that makes sense. Because I think it makes a lot of sense in what we do. Because our word is everything in the industry. I mean, defense lawyers know Ben's not going to try that case, or yeah, Ben, you better offer him. Ben will try that case. And if we don't get to that point, see, I'd love it, but we're great story. You guys will appreciate this because it's very topical and it's going on right now. I know this podcast will not be live until January. I've got a trial starting December 5th. I think it's a pretty good case. I talked to you guys about it. I'm going to send you the video. I made a demand for X amount of dollars. I told the guy, he's like, let's do a mediation before trial. This was Friday. I said, sure. I said, the only way I'll mediate this case is if you start at $1 million. And he's like, okay, fair enough. I appreciate that. Calls me back on Monday and says, all right, good news. I've got a mediator. I got people flying in from Lloyd's of London, et cetera. We're in good shape. My offer is $200,000. And I said, you know, I've got better news for you. You can cancel their flights because no mediation. So I canceled the mediation. We're going to trial. Trust me. Does it give you a little anxiety every once in a while? Like, did I thwart settlement discussions now? But our word is everything. If I'm going to say, you can't, we're not mediating this until you put $1 million on the table, but then all of a sudden they offer 200, like, okay, here's our next response to the 200. I don't know. You've got to, if you're going to walk the walk and talk the talk and all that kind of stuff, you've got to do it. You have to.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm sure you're going to do exceptionally well at trial, and you'll have to come back and tell us what happens.
Well, if you guys can serve as jurors, that would help, I could tell you.
Yeah. So back to that case that you tried to the, what was it, $148 million verdict?
Yeah.
And I read a little bit about it, but can you just share kind of the backstory to it and then maybe talk about how you put it together with your trial themes and overall strategy and approach to putting on the evidence in that case?
Well, it's funny. So I was in the middle of a trial when this incident happened, and I get a call on Monday morning. This happens on a Sunday. They're coming back from Minnesota. Her sisters, like, they're picking out bridal gowns and all that kind of stuff. They're coming back. Horrible rainstorm in Illinois. They call it a microburst where it gets windy for a short period of time, etc. They stand behind a shelter, which I don't know if Maine or I've seen some in California, but you know, like a bus shelter, if it's raining, you could stand under there so you don't get wet. Well, the wind is blowing into the shelter, so they stand behind the shelter. A gust of wind picks up the 750-pound shelter, severs her spinal cord. Severs.
This is at the O'Hare Airport.
O'Hare Airport. So now this happens on a Sunday. On Monday, I get a phone call saying, Jeff, my daughter was injured, blah, blah, blah. And I'm in the middle of a trial, so I send one of my partners to go meet with them. Now, we think this could be big. We file a lawsuit on Wednesday and hold a press conference. Lead story in every station. Thursday, we go in for an emergency motion to preserve and protect everything, make sure nothing is destroyed, which is usually a routine motion. Every news station was there. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, lead story on all the news. Now, there's that saying, the higher the monkey climbs up the tree, the more his ass is exposed. And it couldn't be more true, because our friends in the bar, sometimes they want to see us fail because they want to be the great lawyer. So it was a lot of stress. I took, I think it was in a 65-day span, 26 depositions, and none of them lasted less than 3 hours. But it was just finger pointing.
Who was the defendant in that case?
It was the city of Chicago, because they owned O'Hare. And long story short, there's supposed to be 7 bolts to these shelters. This one only had 2 in the back. There was no repair records, no maintenance records. No one knew who was responsible for it. Maintenance was saying it's facilities. Facilities is saying it's maintenance. It was a great, you know, they don't happen often where there's finger pointing to the same defendant. And it just, they wound up admitting negligence. And then it was damages only. And, you know, some of my concerns, they talk about themes and everything. It's against the city of Chicago. City of Chicago is always crying poor mouth. They're always saying, I was worried about jurors and their taxes going up because of this verdict. So we flushed that out in focus groups. We dealt with that issue. It was funny. The defense lawyer calls me and he's like, I'm getting ready to send over our answers to discovery. I think you're going to like insurance answer. And they had $500 million in insurance, O'Hare. And I respond, I said, I received your answers. Is there an umbrella policy? And that just, I think, set the tone for where we're going in this case. You know, just, but it was, you
know. Is there an umbrella? I like that.
But my biggest concern was, number one, we've got the city of Chicago as defendant. Some people hate the city of Chicago. Some people love them. Number two, we have a young lady that's paralyzed, but she's in horrible pain. One of our focus groups said, the first focus group, if she's paralyzed, she can't feel pain, which forced us to get a pain expert. Not forced us, but we realized we need a pain expert because it was neuropathic pain. And it's these things you learn in a focus group that you would never know. You would never know this unless somebody says this. And that's why it's important. I'm a big advocate of focus groups. I find it amazing that we've got world-class athletes that'll train for 10 years for a 10-second race, but yet we'll have a case that could be worth $1 million or $5 million, and we won't do a practice run on that. I'm just shocked by that. My friends are sick of me because half the time I'm trying to bounce ideas off them. Like, what resonates with you as a non-lawyer? My son's 22, my daughter's 15. Do they believe what I'm saying? Do they buy my theme? Bouncing it off friends, family, 70 people at Thanksgiving, you know, it's just half of them will shut you out. But then every once in a while, you get something you're like, I never even thought about that.
See, this is why you're not invited, Jeff.
Yeah, exactly. I'd be in the corner like, with 50 of his relatives like, so what about this thing? If I said a lane change caused a life change, would that resonate with you? I don't get invited to a lot of Thanksgiving anymore.
Just as an aside, I don't even know if this is appropriate to share, but I would never have my dad on a jury. He is the most conservative guy. Even if he knew I was his son and I tried the case, I'd get defensed in front of him. So
yeah.
He went and hung a jury on a police misconduct case, and he hung it because he thought that the jury was asking for too much. So he said, if you're going to be in that range of too high, then I'm just going to find no negligence on the part of the police officer. And then hung the jury. And that was the end of it. And he, you know, I didn't know about it until afterwards, obviously, because he didn't even tell me he was in a jury trial. But it's so interesting.
I got a better one for you. That I respect your dad more than I'm going to tell you about my mom right now. So my mom is in, there's municipal courts, which are smaller courts. We've got the law division, but then there's municipal courts outside of downtown Chicago that have smaller cases for the most part. My mom calls me and says, I'm on a jury. It's an accident case. And I'm like, oh, good. She's like, you want to know about it? I'm like, you're not supposed to talk about it, Mom. Don't talk about it. So she calls me a couple of days later. She's like, verdict, we delivered a verdict. The lawyer asked for 900 and we gave 800. I'm like, that's humongous out there. It was $900, $800. I thought it was like 900,000. I'm like, oh, that poor guy.
So, Jeff, you were talking about the importance of having mentors when you were coming up through the ranks, and now you're in a position to mentor other lawyers. I know you've taught trial advocacy, and you obviously speak a lot around the country on trial strategy and issues. If our listeners are in that position now of coming up themselves and trying to figure out how to do this kind of work, or maybe they've done it for a while but are looking to get better through your career and your own experiences, what are the kind of big points you would want to convey to them? You know, maybe the top three things that people should be trying to work on and improve to become good as trial lawyers?
Boy, that's a great question. And it's obvious we have not prepared this ahead of time, the questions, because that's right. A great question. But number one is preparation. You can't be over-prepared. It's knowing the entire file, every piece of paper. I mean, how many times have you seen someone crossing one of your witnesses where you're like, where did that document come from? Shoot. And that there's no worse feeling in the world that's trying to have that poker face. You know, where you're like, okay, we're fine. Number two, I honestly think, and something I don't do well at times, be a good listener. Listening to answers, there's nothing worse when you're in front of a jury and it's late in the day on a Friday afternoon and you ask a question and the witness says, like I just said to you, counsel, blah, blah, blah. They're looking at their watch. They're looking behind them at the clock. And it's those things. But it's just know your client. Man, go to their house. Like, see what their surroundings are like. Talk to their spouse. Talk to their kids if they're old enough. Employer, whatever. This is a bad statement. I'm assuming my client is lying on almost everything. So I need to prove what he's saying is, he or she is saying is correct. Because I mean, how many times have you met with a client where you're like, I had the green light, this guy ran in a red light, and all of a sudden you see the police report and there are like four witnesses that say your client ran the red light. And you're like, oh boy, it's just believe your witness, your client. I don't at the outset. The sky is falling. I'm Chicken Little. I don't believe you. I do jury instructions at the outset of the case just so I know what I need to prove. Here's my best advice for you. Not for you, but for listeners. I do this with all my clients. Sometimes it's unbelievable. Sometimes it's not. I tell them, list for me A through Z, A, B, C, going all the way down a page. Give me an activity you no longer can engage in or you know, you're limited in doing since this occurred. So, for example, B is bending. A is aerobics. A is being aerobic. You know, D is dance, whatever. E is exercise. F is whatever. But it's amazing because it gives you that laundry list of your direct examination. I want to ask you about gardening. Did you ever garden? Do you still garden? No. I think that's a phenomenal activity to give your clients because it forces them to really think, because you'll be amazed. They'll forget. Oh, yeah, I forgot. I couldn't bend for like 6 months. Or, you know, I couldn't stairs. I forgot. I couldn't go up and down the stairs. My bed, they moved to the first floor. And because they moved on with their life. So another thing I love saying in a trial, feel free to steal this because I stole it. There's three people you're going to see. Who Ben was, who Ben is, and who Ben's going to be. And who Ben is going to be is if you award the future damages, the economic damages for life care, he will have a normal life expectancy. He will have this. He will have this. If you don't, his life is going to be reduced. So it's who is that person? Who is that person? Who will that person be? I think that's so important when you're thinking through for your trial strategy to think about those three things. Because if you think about every one of your clients, who they were, who they are, who they will be, it's kind of easy to determine that.
Yeah, that's a great framework.
Yeah.
It seems like despite the fact you've been doing this for a while, you're still really enjoying it and having fun and gearing up for another trial as soon as just a few weeks from now.
This is a great, you know, at a seminar, I gave a speech in New Orleans and someone asked me a question and do you enjoy being a trial lawyer? And I gave an answer that everybody laughed at. And then one of the negative reviews was someone that wrote something very negative. But I said, I think it's the most fun you can have with your clothes on. I really do. And everybody laughed except one person wrote a very negative review on that comment. So,
you know what? If you're not offending at least one person, yeah, then you're not saying anything worth saying.
Well, I think I offended them with the visual that I could be naked. I think that's what offended them.
I do find that somewhat offensive myself. The listeners can't see you, but you are fully closed.
Yeah. There's one thing I won't be thankful for tomorrow. Thanks for that, Jeff.
No, visual. It's good. I mean, the amount of haters out there now that raise themselves, I see it a lot on social media, particularly when there's a high-profile case or something that we're involved in. There's always a lot of hate, but I guess that just comes with the territory these days.
It really does. I don't know what it was like in California or Maine, but our courts were closed for an extended period of time because of COVID. And I just felt like that hurt the camaraderie with the plaintiff's bar and defense bar to some extent because everybody's on Zoom. It's great when you go to court because you can talk to people outside in the hallway or what have you. And I shouldn't say we're just getting back to it. We're back to it. But I felt like that gap really hurt. It really hurt the bar.
Yeah, it definitely cut down on the informal socialization you would have, particularly on like travel to depositions and things. We rarely do that these days. It's actually a nice boon, though, for us to not have to fund all that unnecessary travel. I think the defense doesn't like it because they can't have those soft billables anymore. Well, Jeff, we really appreciate your joining us. This was really fascinating. It was great to get to know you, and congratulations on all your success, and looking forward to hearing back about your upcoming trial. If folks are trying to find you, get in touch with you, can you let them know how to do that?
Sure. Our website is www.kaveny.com. And my email is Jeffrey, Jeffrey, at kaveneycroll.com. And I've got literally pages of different themes for cases. So if any of your listeners want some ideas on themes, I can send it to them via email and I'll do whatever I can to help.
I'll take them.
Yeah, that's great. I may take you up on that.
Yeah.
And if you want to share the video, I'm happy to look at it.
I'm sending you the video as soon as we are done with this. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Jeff. You're awesome.
Thanks, guys. Thanks a lot for your time.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.